Maegwin stared, feeling an ugly pressure on her heart. She was sure that light blue dress belonged to Kifka. Little Kifka, pretty and stupid.
If you do not tell us, you know, the Princess Miriamel, things poorly for these.
Scarlet gestured, and the kicking, thinly crying girl, who might not really be Kifka, Maegwin tried to tell herself, was thrown back onto the wagon amidst other pale captives, lying in a row on the wagon bed like fingers. So, it was the Princess Miriamel they sought, she marveled, the High King's daughter. Has she run away? Been stolen? Can't we do anything? She whispered to Aelair. And who is the wizard's boy? The Count shook his head roughly, frustration in every line of his face.
What could we do, Princess? Scully had liked nothing more than to have us come down. He has 10 times the men we have.
Long minutes passed in silence as Maegwin watched, fury tugging at her emotions like a demanding child. She was thinking of what else to say to Aelair and these others. How she'd tell them that if none of the men wanted to go with her, she'd go down to the Take herself and rescue Scarlet's captives, or more likely die bravely in the attempt. When the thick-set figure below, helmet off now, showing the tiny yellow smudge that was his hair and beard, walked back out to the base of the Moya Brach.
Very well, he roared. And look keen, curse, stiff backs, we, and take these with.
The little figure pointed at the wagon.
But leave you a gift.
Something was untied from one of the horses, a dark bundle, and dumped at Scarly Sharpnose's feet.
Just in case, waiting for help. Little use against Kurtzkreiker.
A moment later, he mounted his horse, and with the harsh rasp of a horn, he and his Rimmer's men clattered off up the valley toward Hanisadark, the wagon bumping along behind them. They waited an hour before making their way cautiously down the bank, moving as watchfully as a doe crossing a clearing. Reaching the bottom of the Moya Brach, they scuttled to the black-wrapped bundle Scarly had left behind. When it was opened, the men cried out in horror and wept, great racking sobs of helpless grief. But Maegwin did not shed a tear, even when she saw what Scarly and his butchers had done to her brother Gwythyn before he died. When Aelair put an arm around her shoulders to help her away from the blood-soaked blanket, she shook him off angrily, then turned and slapped hard at his cheek. He did not protect himself, but only stared at her. The tears that filled his eyes, she knew, were not from the blow, and in that moment it made her hate him all the more. But her own eyes remained dry. Flakes of snow filled the air, confusing vision, waiting garments, chilling fingers and ears to a painful tingle. But Jeriki and his 3 Scythi companions seemed not to mind it much. As Simon and the others plodded along on their horses, the Scythi walked jauntily ahead, often stopping to wait for the riders to catch up, patient as well-fed cats, an indecipherable serenity behind their luminous eyes. Walking all day from sunrise to twilight, Jeriki and his fellows nevertheless seemed as light-footed around the camp that night as they had at dawn. Simon hesitantly approached Anne, while the others hunted deadwood for the evening's fire.
May I ask you some questions? He asked.
The Scyther lifted his imperturbable stare.
Ask.
Why was Prince Jeriki's uncle angry that he decided to come with us? And why did he bring you 3 along?
Anne brought a spidery hand up to his mouth as though to cover a smile, although no smile had been present. A moment later, he lowered it again, revealing the same impassive expression.
What passes between the prince and Sue Kendrajaharo is not mine to hold, so I cannot share it either.
He nodded once, gravely.
As to the other, perhaps he can best answer it himself. Yes, Jeriki?
Simon looked up, startled, to find the prince standing behind him,
thin lips taut in a smile.
Why did I bring these?
Jiriki asked, making a sweeping gesture from Anne to the other two Scythi, returning from a search around the thickly forested perimeter of the camping place.
Kiyoshapo and Sijandi, I brought because someone must look after the horses.
Look after the horses? Jiriki raised an eyebrow, then snapped his fingers.
Troll!
He called over his shoulder.
If this man-child is your student, then you are a poor teacher indeed. Yes, Seoman, the horses. Or did you expect to see them climb the mountains beside you?
Simon was flummoxed. But climb? The horses? I didn't think about... I mean to say, couldn't we just leave them? Let them go? It did not seem fair. He had never felt much more than a dangling tassel on his journey, except, of course, for the white arrow. And now the Scyther was holding him accountable for the horses.
Let them go!
Jiriki's voice was harsh, almost angry, but his face was bland.
Leave them to perish, you mean? Once they have been ridden far beyond where they would themselves go, we would free them to struggle back across the snowy wastes. Or die?
Simon was about to protest, to point out that it wasn't his responsibility, but decided it was not worth arguing.
No, he said instead. No, we should not leave them alone to die.
Beside, Sludig said, walking by with an armload of wood, how then would we get back across the wastes ourselves?
Exactly, said Jiriki, his smile stretching.
He was pleased.
So I bring Kiyoshapo and Sijandi. They will tend the horses and prepare things for our return.
He brought the tips of his two index fingers together, as if to indicate some kind of completion.
Now, Anne, he continued, is a more complex matter. His reason for being here is more like mine.
He looked down at the other Scyther.
Honor,
Anne said, eyes downcast, staring at his own interlaced fingers.
I bound the Hikastaja, the arrow bearer. I did not show proper respect for a secret guest. Thus, I come to atone.
A small debt, Jiriki said softly, when compared with my great one.
But Anne will do what he must.
Simon wondered if Anne had decided on his own, or if Jiriki had somehow forced him to join them. It was hard to know anything about these Scythi, how they thought, what they wanted. They were so damnably different, so slow and so subtle.
Come now,
Binnabik announced. A tiny streamer of flame wavered before him, and he fanned it with his hands.
Now we are starting a fire, and I am sure you will all be interested in a little food and wine for the warming of inner spaces.
In the next few days' riding, they left the northern Aldeota behind, coming down off the last decrement of the Wieldhelm Hills onto the flat, snow-swept waste. There was always cold now, every long night, every dreary white day, bitter, biting cold. The snow flew continuously into Simon's face, stinging his eyes, burning and cracking his lips. His face reddened painfully, as if he had gone too long in the sun, and he could hardly hold the reins of his horse for shivering. It was like being thrown out of doors forever, a punishment that had gone on too long. Still, there was nothing he could do to remedy the situation, but offer silent prayers to a series each day for the strength to last until camp was made.
At least,
he reflected sadly, his ears stinging even beneath the hooded cloak,
at least Binnabik is having a good time.
The troll was indeed in his very element, riding ahead, urging his companions on, laughing from time to time for sheer pleasure, as he and Kantaka leaped along the mounting drifts. Long evenings around the fire, while the other mortal companions shivered and oiled their sleet-saturated gloves and boots. Binovic detailed the different types of snow and the various signals portending avalanches, all to prepare them for the mountains that loomed implacably on the horizon before them, stern and judgmental as gods in their crowns of white snow. Every day the great range before them seemed larger, without ever seeming a foot closer, no matter how far they rode. After a week in the warmthless, featureless wastes, Simon began to long for the ill-rumored Dimmuskog forest, or even the wind-lashed heights of the mountains themselves. Anything but this endless, bone-chilling plain of snow. They passed the ruins of St. Skendi's Abbey on the sixth day. It was nearly covered in snowdrifts. Only the spire of the chapel protruded more than a short distance above the surface. An iron tree encircled by the coils of some serpentine beast crowning its rotting roof. Rising up through the frost-laden mist before them, it might have been a ship near sunken in a sea of purest white.
Whatever secrets it may be holding, whatever it knows of Colmond or the sword Thorn, it is holding them too tightly for us,
Binnebik said as their horses trudged past the drowning abbey. Slúdig made a tree on his forehead and heart, his eyes troubled, but the Scythi circled slowly, staring as though they had never seen anything quite so interesting. As the travelers huddled around the campfire that night, Slúdig demanded to know why Jiriki and his comrades had spent so much time examining the lost monastery.
Because, the prince said, we found it pleasing.
What does that mean?
Slúdig asked in irritated puzzlement, looking to Hasten and Grimrick, as if they might know what the Scyther meant.
It is better not to speak of these things, perhaps, said Anne,
making a flattening gesture with his spread fingers.
We are companions at this fire.
Jiriki looked solemnly into the fire for a moment, then his face split in an odd, mischievous grin. Simon marveled. Sometimes it was hard to think of Jiriki as being any older than himself, so young and reckless did his behavior occasionally seem. But Simon also remembered the cavern overlooking the forest. Youth and great age mixed confusedly together. That was what Jiriki was like.
We stare at things that interest us, Jiriki said, just as mortals do. It is only the reasons that are different, and ours you would probably not understand.
His wide smile seemed completely friendly, but now Simon detected a discordant note, something out of place.
The question, Northman, Jiriki continued, is why should our staring offend you so?
For a moment silence descended over the fire circle, as Slúdig stared hard at the Scythi prince. The flames popped and sputtered on the damp wood, and the wind hooted, making the horses shift nervously. Slúdig lowered his eyes.
You may look at what you please, of course, he said, smiling sadly.
His blonde beard was flecked with melting snow.
It is only that it reminded me of Saygod, of the Skibhaven. It was as if you mocked something dear to me.
Skibhaven? Hasten rumbled, sunk in his furs. Never heard of it. Is it a church?
Boats, Grimrick said, screwing up his narrow face in remembrance. There's boats there.
Slúdig nodded, face serious.
You would say Shiphaven. It is where the longships of Rimmersgard lie.
But Rimmer's men donna sail.
Hasten was surprised.
In all Ostenard, no other race be so landbound.
Ah. But we did.
Slúdig's face glowed with reflected firelight.
Before we came across the sea, when we lived in Isgard, in the Lost West, our fathers burned men and buried ships. At least, that is what our tales say.
Burned men? Simon wondered.
The dead, Slúdig explained. Our fathers built death ships of new ashwood, and put the dead to flame on the water, sending their souls up with the smoke. But our great longships, those that carried us on the world's oceans and rivers, the ships that were our lives as surely as a cotsman's acre or a shepherd's flock, those we buried in the ground when they were too old to be seaworthy, so that their souls would go into the trees and make them grow straight and tall to become new ships. But that was across the ocean, you said, long ago, Grimrick pointed out. Say God is here, isn't not, in Ostenad. The city around the fire was silent and unmoving, watching intently as Sludig answered. It is. That is where the keel of Elvrid's boat first touched land, and where he said, we have come across the Black Ocean to a new home. Sludig looked around the circle. They buried the great longships there. Never will we go back across that dragon-haunted sea, Elvrid said. All along the valley floor of Saegard, at the mountain's feet, lie the mounds of the lost ships. On the headland at the water's edge, beneath the biggest howe, they buried Elvrid's ship, Swordfangsel, leaving only its tall mast thrusting up from the earth like a tree with no branches. It was that I saw in my mind when I saw the abbey. He shook his head, eyes bright with memories. Mistletoe grows on Swordfangsel's mast. Every year, on the day of Elvrid's death, the white berries of the mistletoe are gathered by young maidens of Saegard and taken to the church. Sludig trailed off. The fire hissed.
What you do not tell, Jiriki said after a while, is how your Rimasgard people came to this land only to drive others from it.
Simon breathed in sharply. He had sensed something like this beneath the prince's placid surface. Sludig replied with surprising mildness, perhaps still thinking of the pious maidens of Saegard.
I cannot undo what my ancestors have done.
There is truth to that, Jiriki said, but neither will we, Zidea, we Sithi, make the same mistake our kin made before us.
He turned his fierce stare on Binnabik, who met it solemnly.
Some things should be made clear between us all, Binbinike Kabenik. I spoke only truth when I gave my reasons for accompanying you. Some interest that I have in where you go, and a frail, unusual bond between the man-child and myself. Do not for a moment believe that I share your fears or struggles. As far as I am concerned, you and your High King may grind each other to dust. With respectfulness, Prince Jiriki, Binnabik said, you are not examining the full truth. If it was only the struggling of mortal kings and princes that concerned us, we would all of us be defending Naglimund. You know that we five, at least, are having other goals. Then know this, Jiriki said stiffly. Though the years that have passed since we were sundered from the Hikadea, those you call the Norns are as numerous as snowflakes, still we are one blood. How could we take the side of upstart men against our kin? Why should we, when once we walked together beneath the sun, coming out of the ultimate east? What allegiance could we possibly owe to mortals who have destroyed us as eagerly as they destroy all else, even themselves?
None of the humans but Binnabik could meet his cold gaze. Jiriki lifted a long finger before him.
And the one you whisperingly call the Storm King, he whose name was Ineluki.
He smiled bitterly as the companion stirred and shivered.
Ah, even his name is fearsome. He was the best of us once, beautiful to see, wise, far beyond the understanding of mortals, bright burning as a flame. If he is now a thing of dark horror, cold and hateful, whose is the fault? If now, bodiless and vengeful, he schemes to brush mankind from the face of his land, like dust from a page, why should we not rejoice? It was not Inaluki who drove us into exile, so that we must hide among Aldeota's dark trees, like deer, wary always of discovery. We strode Austin-Ard in the sunlight, before men came, and the works of our hands were beautiful beneath the stars. What have mortals ever brought to us but suffering?
No one could make reply, but in the stillness after Jiriki's words, a plaintive, quiet sound arose. It hovered in the darkness, full of unknown words, a melody of spectral beauty. When he had finished singing, Anne looked to his silent prince and his Scythi companions, then to those who faced them across the dancing flames.
"It is a song of ours that mortals once sang," he murmured. "The Western men loved it of old, and gave it words in their tongue. I will try to give it words in yours."
He looked up into the sky as he thought. The wind was slowing, and as the snow flurries died, the stars shone through, cold and remote.
"Moss grows on the stones of Seni Ojihisa,"
Anne sang at last, the clicks and liquid vowels of Scythi speech muted.
"The shadows are lingering, still as if listening. The trees have embraced Dai Chikisa's bright towers. The shadows all whispering, dark on the leaves. Long grass is waving above Enki Ishaose. The shadows are growing upon the sward lengthening. The grave of Nenesu wears a mantle of flowers. The shadowed brook silent, and no one there grieves. Where are they gone? Now the woods are all silence. Where are they gone? The song vanished away. Why will they come no more, dancing at twilight? Their lamps, the stars' messengers, at ending of day."
As Anne's voice rose, caressing the mournful words, Simon felt a longing such as he had never felt, a homesickness for a home he had never known, a sense of loss over something that had never belonged to him. No one spoke as Anne sang. No one could have.
"Sea beats above the dark streets of Jinatsene. The shadows are hiding in deep grottos slumbering. Blue ice freezes tomate, entombs its sweet bowers. The shadows have stained all the pattern time weaves. Where are they gone? Now the woods are all silence. Where are they gone? The song vanished away. Why will they come no more? Dancing at twilight, their lamps the stars' messengers, at ending of day."
The song ended. The fire was a solitary bright spot in a wasteland of shadows. The green tent stood by itself in the damp emptiness of the plain before the walls of Naglamund. Its sides heaved and rippled in the wind, as though it alone of all the other things that might move unseen in that vastly open place was breathingly alive. gritting his teeth against a superstitious shiver, although the dank, knife-like wind was reason enough to let them go a-chattering. Deonoth looked over to Joshua, riding slightly ahead.
"Look at him," he thought. "It's as though he saw his brother already. Just as if his eyes could see right through the green silk and the black dragon crest, right into Elias' heart."
Gazing back to the third and last member of their party, Deonoth felt his heavy heart sink further. The young soldier whom Joshua had insisted on bringing, Ostrael his name was, looked ready to faint from pure fright. His blunt, square features, their sun-reddening faded now by the sunless weeks of spring, were screwed tight in barely suppressed terror.
"The Aiden save us if he's got to be any use. Why on earth did Joshua pick him?"
As they slowly approached, the tent flap parted. Deonoth tensed, ready to grab for his bow. He had an instant to curse himself for allowing his prince to do such a foolish, foolish thing as this. But the green-cloaked soldier who emerged only looked up at them incuriously, then stepped to the side of the door, holding the flap open. Deonoth signed respectfully for Joshua to wait and spurred his horse into a quick circuit at the green tent. It was large, a dozen paces or more on each side, and the guy ropes thrummed with the wind-buffeted weight of it, but the flattened grass all around was empty of ambushes.
"Very well, Ostrea," he said, returning. "You will stand here next to this man," he indicated the other soldier, "with at least one of your shoulders visible in the doorway at all times, yes?"
Taking the young pikeman's sickly smile for an affirmative, Deonoth turned to the king's guard. The man's bearded face was familiar. Doubtless he had seen him at the hayholt.
"If you two would stand near the doorway, it would be better for all concerned."
The guard showed him a curled lip, but edged a step nearer the entrance. Joshua had already dismounted and moved to the door, but Deonoth stepped quickly through ahead of him, with one hand resting lightly on his sword hilt.
"There is scarcely need for such caution, Deonoth," a soft but penetrating voice said. "That is your name, is it not? After all, we are all gentlemen here."
Deonoth blinked as Joshua stepped in behind him. It was bitingly cold inside and dark. The walls glowed faintly, letting in only a green fraction of the light outside, as though the tent's occupants floated inside a huge but imperfectly cut emerald. A pale face loomed before him, the black eyes pinpoint holes into nothingness. Pirati's scarlet robe was rusty brown in the green murk, the color of dried blood.
"And Joshua," he said, horrible levity in his voice, "we meet again. Who would ever have thought so many things would have happened since our last conversation?"
"Shut your mouth, priest, or whatever you are," the prince snapped back.
There was such cold strength in his voice that even Priorates blinked in surprise, like a startled lizard.
"Where is my brother?"
"I am here, Joshua,"
a voice said, a deep, cracked whisper that seemed to echo the wind. A figure sat in a high-backed chair in the corner of the tent, a low table resting nearby, another chair before it, the only furniture in the huge, shadowy tent. Joshua moved closer. Deonoth pulled his cloak tighter and followed, more from an urge not to be left with Priorates than any hurry to see the king. The prince took the chair facing his brother. Elias sat strangely stiff, his eyes bright as gems in his hawkish face, his black hair and pale brow bound by the iron crown of the hayholt. Propped between his legs was a sword, scabbarded in black leather. The High King's powerful hands rested on the pommel, above the strange double hilt. Although he stared for a moment, Deonoth's eyes did not want to rest on the sword. It gave him a queasy, unwell feeling, like glancing down from some great height. Instead, he looked back up to the king, but this was scarcely better. In the freezing cold of the tent, the air so chill that a mist of breath hung before Deonoth's own eyes, Elias wore only a sleeveless jerkin, his white arms bare to his heavy bracelets, the sinews pulsing beneath the skin as though they had a life of their own.
"So,"
Brother, the king said, baring his teeth in a smile, you are looking well. As you are not, Joshua said flatly, but Deornoth could see the worried pinch of his eyes. Something was terribly wrong here. Anyone could sense it. You called for the parley, Elias. What do you want? The king narrowed his eyes, masking them in green shadow, and waited a long while before he replied. My daughter. I want my daughter. There is another, too. A boy. But he is less important. No, it is Miriam Mel I chiefly want. If you hand her over to me, I will give my word of safe conduct to all children and womenfolk in Naglamund. Otherwise, all who hide behind its walls and thwart me will die. He said this last with such casual lack of malice that Deornoth was startled by the hungry look that flitted nakedly across his face. I do not have her, Elias, Joshua replied slowly. Where is she? I do not know. Liar! The king's voice was so full of anger that Deornoth almost drew his sword, expecting Elias to leap from his chair. Instead, the king remained nearly motionless, only gesturing for Priorates to refill his goblet from a ewer full of some black liquid. Do not think me a bad host for not offering you any, Elias said, after he had taken a long swallow. He smiled grimly. I fear this liquor would not agree with you. He handed the cup to Priorates, who took it gingerly between his fingertips and lowered it to the table. Now, Elias resumed, his tone almost reasonable, can we not spare ourselves this useless byplay? I want my daughter, and I will have her. His tone turned grotesquely plaintive. Does not a father have a right to the daughter he loved and raised? Joshua took a deep breath. What rights you have are between you and her. I do not have her, and I would not give her unwilling to you if I did. He continued hastily before the king could respond. Come, Elias, please. You were my brother once in all things. Our father loved us both, you more than me, but he loved this land more. Can you not see what you are doing? Not just with this struggle. Aiden knows this land has seen war aplenty. But there is something else here. Priorates knows what I speak of. He it was that guided your first steps down the path, I do not doubt. Deornoth saw Priorates turn, spewing a surprised cloud of breath at the prince's words. Please, Elias, Joshua said, his stern face full of woe. Turn back only from the course you have chosen. Send that cursed sword back to those unholy ones who would poison you and Austin Ard. And I will lay my life in your hands. I will open Naglamund's gates to you, as a maiden unshuts her window for a lover. I will turn every stone in heaven and earth to find Miriam Mel. Throw away the sword, Elias. Throw it away. Not by accident was it named Sorrow. The king stared at Joshua as if stunned. Priorates, muttering, rushed forward, but Deornoth leaped and caught him. The priest squirmed beneath his restraining arm like a snake, and his touch was horrible, but Deornoth held fast. Do not move, he hissed in Priorates' ear. Though you blast me with a spell, still I will cut the life from you before I die. He prodded the side of the scarlet robe with his drawn dagger, just far enough to touch cloaked flesh. You have no place in this, neither do I. This is between brothers. Priorates became quiet. Joshua was leaning forward, staring at the High King. Elias looked on, as though he had trouble seeing what was before him. She is beautiful, my Miriam Mel, he half whispered. In her, I sometimes see her mother. Ilyssa, poor, dead girl. The king's face, frozen a moment before in malice, collapsed into confusion. How could Joshua have let it happen? How could he? She was so young. Groping, his white hand reached out. Joshua held his own out too late. Instead of catching it,
The king's long, cold fingers alighted on the leather-bound stump of the prince's right wrist. His eyes flared into life, and his face stiffened into a mask of rage.
"Go to your hiding hole, traitor!"
he snarled as Joshua snatched his arm away.
"Liar! Liar! I will shake it down around your ears!"
Such hatred beat out from the king that Deonoth staggered back, letting Priorates wriggle free.
"I will ruin you so completely,"
Elias thundered, squirming in his chair as Joshua walked to the tent door,
"that God all-powerful will search 1,000 years and never find even your soul."
The young soldier, Ostrael, was so terrified by the faces of Deonoth and the prince that he wept silently, all the wind-racked way back to Naglamund's brooding walls. Chapter 41 Cold Fire and Grudging Stone. The dream gradually receded, melting like mist, a terrifying dream in which he was surrounded by choking green sea. There was no up or down, only sourceless light all around, and a host of slicing shadows, sharks, each one with the lifeless black eyes of Priorates. As the sea slid away, Deonoth broke surface, flailing up out of sleep into bleary half-wakefulness. The walls of the guard barracks were spotted with cold moonlight, and the steady breathing of the other men was like the wind pushing through dry leaves. Even as his heart fluttered swiftly in his breast, he felt sleep reaching out again to reclaim his exhausted soul, soothing him with feathery fingers, whispering voicelessly in his ear. He began to slide back, the tidal pull of dream gentler than before. This time it carried him toward a brighter place, a place of morning damp and gentle noontime sun. His father's freeholding in Huonshire, where he had grown up working in the fields beside his sisters and older brother. A part of him had not left the barracks, it was before dawn, he knew, the 9th day of Yuvan, but another part had fallen back into the past. Again he smelled the musk of turned earth, and heard the patient creaking of the plough traces, and the measured chirp of cartwheels, as the ox pulled the wagon down the road toward market. The creaking became louder, even as the pungent, muddy smell of the furrows began to fade. The plough was coming closer. The wain sounded to be just behind. Were the ox drivers asleep? Had someone let the oxen wander, trampling into the fields? He felt a childish horror.
"My dad'll be right mad. Was it me? Was I supposed to watch him?"
He knew how his father would look. The puckered, rage-mottled face that would hear no excuse. The face young Deonoth had always thought of God sending a sinner down to hell.
"Mother Elysia, Dar's gonna get the strop to me, sure."
He sat upright on his pallet, breathing hard. His heart was stumbling as badly as after the shark dream, but it began to slow as he looked around the barracks.
"How long have you been dead, father?"
he wondered, wiping the swiftly cooling sweat from his forehead with his wrist.
"Why do you haunt me still? Have not the years and prayers?"
Deonoth suddenly felt a cold finger of fear trace his spine. He was awake now, was he not? Then why hadn't the remorseless creaking noise disappeared with his half-dream? He was on his feet in a moment, shouting, dead father's ghost blown out like a candle.
"Up, men! Up! To arms! The siege is begun!"
Struggling into his mail coat, he went down the line of cots, kicking wakefulness into the groggy and wine-addled, calling instructions to those whom his first cry had brought suddenly to life. There were shouts of alarm from the gatehouse above, and the ragged bleat of a trumpet. His helmet sat askew on his head, and his shield thumped his side as he trotted out the door, struggling with his sword belt. Poking his head into the other barracks room, he saw the denizens already up and swiftly arming themselves.
"Oh, Naglamundus!"
he called, waving a fist while he held the belt closed with the other.
"Now the test, God love us! Now the test!"
He smiled at the ragged shout that answered him and headed for the stairs, straightening his helmet. The top of the greater gatehouse, in the western curtain wall, looked strangely misshapen by the light of the half-moon overhead. The hoardings had been finished only days before, wooden walls and roof that would protect the defenders from arrows.
Already the top of the gatehouse was swarming with partially dressed guards, flitting forms weirdly banded by the moonbeams that bled past the hoarding walls. Torches bloomed along the wall, as archers and pikemen took their positions. Another trumpet squalled, like a rooster who had despaired of dawn's arrival, summoning more soldiers out to the courtyard below. The shrill protest of wooden wheels grew louder. The Ornoth stared out across the denuded, downsloping plain before the town wall, looking for the source of the noise, knowing what it would be, but still unprepared for the actual sight. "God's bloody tree," he swore, and heard the man beside him repeat the oath. Moving toward them as slowly as hobbled giants, taking form out of the pre-dawn shadows, were six great siege towers, their wooden summits fully as high as Naglamund's mighty curtain wall. Hung all over in dark hides, they slouched forward like tree-tall, square-headed bears. The grunts and cries of the hidden men who pushed them, and the screech of the wheels, big as houses, seemed the voices of monsters unseen since the eldest days. Deornoth felt a not unpleasant rush of fear. The king had come at last, and now his army was at their door. By the good God, people would sing of this someday, whatever happened. "Save your arrows, fools!" he shouted, as a few of the defenders launched wild shots into the darkness, the missiles falling far short of their still distant targets. "Wait, wait, wait! Soon enough they will be closer than you'll like." Elias' army, in response to the flowering of fire on Naglamund's walls, let their drums thunder out through the darkness, a great rolling rumble that gradually resolved into a plodding two-part tread, as of titan footsteps. The defenders blew horns from every tower, a faint and tinny sound against the crash of the drums, but one that nonetheless betokened life and resistance. Deornoth felt a touch at his shoulder and looked up to see two armored shapes beside him, bare-helmed Isorn and glowering Einskaldir in a cap of steel unadorned but for a metal beak that hooked down over the nose. The dark-bearded Rimmer's man's eyes burned like the torchlight, as he laid a firm hand on his master, Iskrimnor's son, moving Isorn carefully but forcibly out of the way so he could stride to the parapet. Staring out into the dimness, Einskaldir growled dog-like under his breath. "There," he snarled, pointing to the bases of the siege towers, "at the big bear's feet, the stone chuckers and the ram." He indicated other large engines moving in the wake of the towers. Several were catapults, long, strong arms cocked back like the heads of startled snakes. Others seemed merely hide-covered boxes, their workings hidden by their armor, designed to come safely like hard-shelled crabs through the arrows and stones to the wall, where they would perform whatever tasks they had been assigned. "Where is the prince?" Deornoth asked, unable to tear his eyes from the crawling engines. "Coming," Isorn replied, standing on his toes to try to look over Einskaldir. "He has been with Jarn Auge and the Archive Master since you returned from the parley. I hope they are preparing some wondrous device to give us strength, or to sap the king's. Struth, Deornoth, look at them all." He pointed at the dark, swarming shapes of the king's army, numerous as ants behind the slow-rolling towers. "They are so damnably many." "Aedan's wounds," Einskaldir snarled, and turned a red eye back on Isorn. "Let them come. We will eat them and spit them out." "There," said the Ornoth, and hoped he had made a smile come to his face as he intended. "With God, the prince, and Einskaldir, what have we to fear?" The king's army came onto the flatlands in the trail of siege engines, swarming over the mist-soaked meadows like flies on a green apple skin. Tents seemed to push up everywhere from the moist earth, like angular mushrooms. Dawn came quietly as the besiegers moved into place. The hidden sun peeled away only a single layer of night's darkness, leaving the world suspended in directionless gray light. The great siege towers, which had stood in place for a long hour, like dozing sentries, suddenly moved forward again. Soldiers dodged in and out among the mighty wheels, heaving on the guy ropes as the massive engines rolled laboriously uphill. At last they came within range. The archers on the walls let fly, shouting with terrified joy when the arrows went hissing out, as though they let go the tight tethers on their hearts with the bowstrings. After the first wobbly barrage, they began to find the range. Many of the king's men dropped dead in their tracks, or lay wounded as the remorseless wheels of their own engines ground them screaming into the turf. But for every one who fell, arrow-pierced, another of the helmeted and blue-jacketed engineers leaped forward to take up his guy-rope. The siege towers rumbled on toward the walls, undeterred. Now the king's archers on the ground were close enough to return fire. Arrows flickered back and forth between the walls and the earth below, like maddened bees. As the engines rattled and creaked toward the curtain wall, the sun broke through for a short moment. Already the battlements were red-sprinkled in places, as if with a gentle rain.
Deonoth!
The soldier's white face, dirt-streaked, shone within his helmet like a full moon.
Grimstader bids you come, and soon! They have brought ladders against the wall below Dendinus Tower.
Stray! Deonoth clenched his teeth in frustration and turned to look for Isorn. The Rimmersman had taken a bow from a wounded guardsman and was helping to keep clear the last few ells of ground between the nearest siege tower and the wall, skewering any soldier fool enough to come out from the stalled tower's protective skirts and try and take up the loose guy ropes fluttering in the wind.
Isorn! Deonoth shouted. While we keep the towers at bay, they bring ladders to the southwest wall.
Go then, Iskrimnor's son did not look up from his arrow tip.
I will join you when I may. But where is Einskaldir?
From the corner of his eye, he saw the messenger jigging up and down in fearful impatience.
God knows.
Cursing again under his breath, Deonoth lowered his head and ran clumsily along behind Sir Grimstader's messenger. He gathered half a dozen guardsmen as he went, tired men who had slumped down for a moment in the lee of the battlement to catch their breath. Summoned, they shook their heads regretfully, but donned their helms and followed. Deonoth was well trusted. Many called him the prince's right hand.
But Joshua had poor luck with his first right hand, Deonoth thought sourly,
as he hunched along the walkway, sweating despite the cold grey air.
I hope he keeps this one longer. And where is the prince, anyway? Of all times, he should be seen.
Rounding the great bulk of Dendinus Tower, he was shocked to see Sir Grimstader's men falling back, and the swarming red and blue colours of Baron Godwig's Kelidshire men pouring over the battlement onto the curtain wall.
For Joshua!
He shouted, leaping forward. The men behind him echoed his cry. They came against the besiegers with a tinny crash of sword on sword, and for a moment pushed the shiremen back. One toppled from the wall shrieking, windmilling his arms as though the chill wind might bear him up. Grimstader's men took heart and pushed forward. While the enemy was engaged again, Deonoth pulled a pike from the stiff grasp of a sprawled corpse, suffering a hard blow to his body from a stray spear butt, and pushed the first of the tall ladders away from the wall. A moment later, two of his guardsmen had joined him, and together they levered the ladder out. It went shivering into open space as the besiegers on it clung and cursed, their mouths gaping like black empty holes. For a moment it stood free, halfway between earth and heaven and perpendicular to both. Then the ladder overbalanced backward toward the ground below, shedding soldiers like fruit from a shaken branch. Soon, all but a pair of red and blue lay in their blood on the walkway. The defenders pushed the remaining three ladders away, and Grimstader had his men roll up one of the large stones they had not had time to move at the assault's beginning. They tipped it over the low spot on the wall so that it went crashing down on the toppled ladders, splintering them like kindling and killing one of the ladder men who sat where he had tumbled, staring idiotically as the great stone rolled down upon him. One of the defending guardsmen, a bearded young fellow who had diced with Deonoth once, lay dead, his neck broken by the edge of a shield. Four of Sir Grimstader's men had also fallen, crumpled like wind-toppled scarecrows among seven men of Kelidshire, who had also not survived the failed assault. Deonoth was feeling the blow on his stomach, and stood panting as gap-toothed Grimstader limped over to stand beside him. A ragged, bloody hole in the calf of his boot.
"'Tis seven here,
and half-dozen more tumbled off the ladder, the knight said, staring down with satisfaction on the writhing bodies and wreckage below. All down the wall it's the same. Losing far more than we, King Elias, is. Far more. Deornoth felt ill, and his wounded shoulder throbbed as though a nail had been driven into it. The king has far more than we do, he replied. He can toss them away like apple peelings. Now he knew he would be sick, and moved toward the edge of the wall. Apple peelings, he said again, and leaned over the parapet, too pained to feel shame.
Read it again, please, Yanaga said quietly, staring at his knitted fingers.
Father Strangyard looked up, his weary mouth open to form a question. Instead, a bone-jarring thump from outside brought a look of panic to the one-eyed priest's face, and he quickly traced a tree on the breast of his black robe.
Stones, he said, his voice shrill. They are throwing stones over the wall. Shouldn't we? Isn't there?
The men fighting atop the walls are in danger too, the old Rimmersgarde said, his face stern. We are here because we best serve here. Our comrades search for one sword in the White North, against lethal odds. Another is in the hands of our enemy already, even as he besieges our walls. What little hope there is of discovering what happened to Fingal's blade, Minayar, lies with us.
His expression softened as he regarded the worried Strangyard.
The few stones that reach the inner keep must come over the high wall behind this room. We are at little risk. Now please, read that passage again. There is something in it I cannot quite touch, but that seems important.
The tall priest stared down at the page for some moments, and as the room fell into silence, a wave of cries and exhortations, muffled by distance, stole through the window like a mist. Strangyard's mouth twitched.
Read, suggested Yarnauga.
The priest cleared his throat.
And so, John went down into the tunnels beneath the hayholt, steaming vents and sweating passageways, alive with the breath of Shurike. Unarmed but for a spear and shield, his very boot leather smoking as he neared the fire drake's den. He was, there is little doubt, as frightened as he ever would be in his long life.
Strangyard broke off.
What use is this, Yarnauga?
Something thudded into the soil a short distance away, with a sound like the fall of a giant's hammer. Strangyard stoically ignored it.
Do you want me to go on? Through all King John's battle with the dragon?
No, Yanaga waved a gnarled hand. Go to the ending passage.
The priest carefully turned a few leaves.
Thus it was that he came out again, into the light, beyond any hope of return. Those few who had remained at the cave mouth, this itself an indication of great bravery, for who could know what might happen at the door of an angered dragon's tunnel? Swore great oaths of joy and astonishment. Joy when they saw John of Warinsten come up alive from the worm's den, and astonishment at the massive claw, crimson-scaled and hook-taloned, that he bore upon his bloody shoulder. As they went shouting down the road before him, leading his horse triumphantly through the gates of Urchester, the people came gaping to their windows and into the streets. Some say that those who had loudest prophesied John's horrible death, and the dire consequences to themselves of the young knight's actions, were now most audible in their acclaim of his great deed. As word spread, the roads were quickly lined with clamoring citizens who threw flowers before John as he rode. Bright nail lifted before him like a torch flame, through the city that was now his own.
Sighing, Strangyard gently put the manuscript pages back into the cedar box he had found to house them.
A lovely and frightening story, I would say, Yarnauga. And Morgaini's, yes, he puts things wonderfully.
But what use to us? No disrespect, you understand. Yarnauga squinted at his own prominent knuckles and frowned.
I do not know. Something. There is something there. Dr. Morghenis, whether he wished to or no, put something there. Sky and clouds and stones, I can almost touch it. I feel blind.
Another wash of noise came through the window. Loud, worried shouts and the weighty chink of armor as a troop of guards jogged past in the commons outside.
I do not think we have long to ponder, Yarnauga, Strangyard said finally. Nor do I, said the old man, and rubbed his eyes.
All through the afternoon, the tide of King Elias' army dashed itself against Naglamund's stony cliffs. The weak sunlight struck glinting shards of reflection from polished metal, as wave after wave of mailed and helmeted soldiers swarmed up the ladders, only to be repelled by the castle's defenders. Here and there the king's forces found a momentary breach in the ring of stern men and grudging stone, but they were always pushed back. Fat Ordmayr, Baron of Utasol, held one such gap alone for long minutes, battling hand-to-hand with the scaling soldiers, mounting the ladders from below, slaying four of them and keeping the rest at bay until help arrived, although he got his own death wound in the fighting. It was Prince Joshua himself who brought up a troop of guards, securing the length of wall and destroying the ladder. Joshua's sword, Nadel, was a ray of sunlight flickering through leaves, snicking swiftly in and out, making dead men from living, while his attackers swung clumsy broadswords or inadequate daggers. The prince cried when Ordmayr's body was found. There had been no love lost between the Baron and himself, but Ordmayr's death had been a heroic one, and in the pulse of battle his fall suddenly seemed to Joshua representative of all the others, all the